Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our October series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. This is our contribution to the People's Guide to Power series. Our news team has begun in conjunction with this year's elections in New York and New Jersey. What unbalanced power relationships contribute to making housing so unaffordable in Greater New York decade after decade? Even as every New York mayor announces historic affordable housing programs and every New Jersey governor comes with a plan to get property taxes under control. We're doing segments on these things throughout the month of October here on The Brian Lehrer Show, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. During this first week of the series, we've been going back in time for some of the roots of today's unaffordability crisis with the help of our history-hoarding friends at the WNYC Archives and the New York City Municipal Archives. Today, it's the rise and partial fall of rent control and rent stabilization. Those laws were passed after World War II when the city was facing another affordable housing shortage. We go back first to 1960 when the landlord lobby was already hard at work trying to undo those laws. In those days, there was a series on WNYC called You and Your Landlord, broadcast on the second and fourth Fridays of every month. And on November 22nd, 1968, the guest was Rex Tompkins, president of the real estate company Brown Harris Stevens and treasurer of the New York Real Estate Board. Tompkins, in this clip, accuses the people of New York of getting housing all wrong and calls for re-education.
I really foresee the necessity of re-educating the public on the subject of housing and the relationship of housing to government. Unfortunately, New York City, since it was the city having the most tenant-occupied units after the war, was faced with a peculiar political problem in that housing became, in everybody's mind, something that was provided by the government. And gradually there has evolved in this city a kind of a feeling that the housing should be available at a price that a tenant thinks is fair with no relevance to any economic criteria.
So maybe he didn't call for re-education camps, but he called for massive re-education of the public on the relationship between government and housing. And just the opposite of what we see today, he claimed in 1960 that New Yorkers pay less than people elsewhere for housing and less than the generally accepted rule of thumb of about a quarter of your income.
New York City is paying much less on an overall basis for housing than any other city in the country. And that, I'm talking about the consumer. In other words, the consumer has lost the feeling that he must pay a fair share of the consumer income in order to maintain housing stock. But it, so from what I can see, the ratio of about 1 week's salary for rent is still a valid one economically. And and whether the city provides the housing or whether private enterprise provides it, that is a fundamental rule of thumb as to what housing has to cost.
A quarter of your income for rent. Nice percentage if you can get it. These days, according to a 2013 analysis by the Furman Center at NYU, which studies housing policy, most New York renters are paying 30% or more of their income for rent. That's the level at which Furman calls them rent burdened, over 30%. Many spend a much higher percentage. Next stop on our history tour, 1997, when the landlord succeeded in prying open some giant loopholes in the rent stabilization law that have allowed many apartments to go market rate ever since. Here's a 2-minute excerpt from a C-SPAN news report as 1997 was starting about the campaign in progress led by the Republican State Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, who represented upstate Rensselaer County, his district, but had a lot of power over New York City's renters.
We're not trying to hurt anybody in the city. We're not trying to scare anybody. What we're trying to do is fix something that's not working properly.
But the 2 million tenants who live in rent-regulated apartments in New York City and its suburbs were scared. Organizers mobilized them to come to Albany. Widow Helen Auerbach was afraid her landlord would jack up her rent.
But you could see your rent, which is about $700 a month for a one-bedroom, and you could see that go up.
Way up, because they are now renting the apartments there for a one-bedroom, $1,400, and a two-bedroom, $2,300.
You're worried.
So, worried. I don't know where to go.
Wearing hats that said, "I'm a tenant, I vote," the coalition issued threats to members of the Senate Republican majority. But the Republicans hung together until Governor Pataki offered what he called a compromise that would protect most existing tenants, but end regulations when a tenant moved out. In May, thousands of tenants poured into the Capitol to protest his approach called vacancy decontrol.
Hands off my home. Leave my home alone.
Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, who was hailed as a hero by the crowd, said Republicans Pataki and Bruno were using the old good cop, bad cop routine.
They played with you.
Pataki tried selling his approach to a group of elderly tenants in Brooklyn.
And let me tell you what my position and what my plan would do. First, it protects every single senior citizen.
And I don't think you have explained it properly. Because if there are any beginnings on changing the laws, you've opened the door, and next year will be this, and next year will be that.
So that excerpt from a show called New York Year in Review that aired as 1997 was beginning, and you heard Governor Pataki, the governor at the time, being heckled at the end of that C-SPAN clip. 6 months later, in June of 1997, they reached a compromise. On this program, we were covering the negotiations every day that year in a series we called Rent Control Countdown. Here, and get ready to laugh, is the opening of this program from June 16th, 1997. The first thing you'll hear is the theme song we used in those days. It happened at 8 minutes after midnight. It was announced at 2 a.m. Governor Pataki and legislative leaders reached agreement on a deal to extend rent protections for at least 6 years in New York State. Here are the highlights of the detail of the deal in some detail. There is no vacancy decontrol in the sense the governor proposed it. Vacant apartments will not go to market rates, but landlords will get something extra when rent-stabilized units change hands. If the departing tenant had been living there for at least 2 years, the vacancy bonus will be a 20% rent increase. If the departing tenant had been there more than 8 years, it'll be even more. Plus, if the apartment had been renting for under $300 a month, the rent would go up by another $100 a month. Some details of the vacancy bonus plan remain sketchy, and we'll try to clear them up with our first guest. Well, obviously, somebody edited out the theme, but that was the start of our show on June 16th, 1997. We went on to break down the rent laws deal with tenant activist Scott Summer. I asked him this question, and spoiler alert, a certain name we hear a lot in the news today for other reasons concludes this clip.
Now, since most neighborhoods in the city don't have a 20% difference between market and stabilized rents, this is really a deal for owners in the prime Manhattan neighborhoods, wouldn't you say?
This is more of a deal for, the bonus, the vacancy bonuses here are clearly more of a deal for the larger, richer institutional landlords, which have really been the client of Governor Pataki all along. I mean, the plight of the small owners was the straw man and the lip service of the RSA and the governor, but, the large contributions, which I know, you've covered on your show also, really came from the large institutional rich landlords, the Lou Rudens, the Donald Trumps.
So, yes, the rent laws were weakened in 1997, at least as the housing activists saw it, for the sake of Donald Trump and other big landlords. That clip from our show in 1997, happy 20th anniversary,
weakening of the rent stabilization system. Let's talk about rent control and stabilization history and where we are today with Emily Goldstein, senior campaign organizer for the housing advocacy group ANHD. That's the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Thanks for coming on, Emily. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Were you involved in this work yet in 1997?
I wasn't, although I did live in a rent-stabilized apartment in New York City at the time, so I had some sense.
Funny thing is, the media, including, I acknowledge, this show, portrayed the agreement as mostly a victory for tenants at first. Some of the main landlord lobby goals for undoing the system more quickly were defeated. But I think history has shown that the law opened a giant sieve that has allowed landlords to renovate apartments when current tenants move out to a modest degree. And the threshold that was in that law was if they can be brought up to a $2,500 a month rent and declare them market rate. So how do you understand the intent and actual effects of the 1997 law?
I think you've characterized it well. I think it's been it was a chipping away, and the erosion of rent stabilization protections didn't happen all in one fell swoop, but had really a huge cumulative impact on tenants, on the overall housing stock of New York City, and I think on expectations about what kinds of controls will exist in the market and what affordability will look like.
Did Donald Trump benefit from that rollback, as the guest that day suggested? Do you happen to know?
I'm sure he did. He owns rent-stabilized housing, or at least did at the time. Some of it's changed hands since then, and he's certainly benefited from other loopholes in affordability regulations.
And listeners, anything you want to say or ask about the history of rent control and rent stabilization, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The clip we played from 1960 with that real estate industry leader saying New Yorkers pay too little for rent, less than any other city at the time, and rent should be allowed to rise to a quarter of people's incomes. That's a pretty quaint idea, isn't it? That rents might have been below a quarter of the average New Yorker's income.
Yeah, that's never been a concern in my career.
And I question, and I haven't had the chance to go back and really look at very old numbers, but I question if it was even true in 1960. But do you know if it was ever true that, you know, New Yorkers paid less than people in most other cities in 1960?
You know, I honestly don't know. New York had some of the strongest protections compared to other cities, and so I suppose it's possible those were having an impact.
Why is 25% of income considered a housing cost rule of thumb?
It's actually sort of bumped up a little to 30 now, so we've backtracked slightly. It's the way the federal government sets the standards for sort of how they measure affordability, looking at other cost of living, what else you need money for, food, education, clothing. And it's the standard at which Section 8 voucher payments are set, and so that's sort of trickled into the industry standard.
How do you see that ratio today, and how burdened the city is in general with rents? I mentioned the Furman Center study, which is 4 years old now, but I imagine it still roughly applies. If anything, it's probably a little bit worse today, showing more than half of New Yorkers pay more than 30% of their income in rent. And as you go down the income scale, I imagine it's much more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Rent burden is a huge problem in New York City, has consistently been a problem for years now, and has been largely, you know, getting worse over the years. And it is, I mean, the numbers at the lowest income brackets are almost hard to fathom. It's somewhere around 85% of the very lowest income New Yorkers are rent burden.
I wonder if that Brown Harris Stevens president from 1960 would agree to a law today that would allow a cap on rents to 25% of a tenant's income. Do even activists like you propose anything like that?
I mean, it does beg the question, right? If you're thinking about what is fair and what is reasonable, and you want to go up when somehow rents were too low, you know, if the standard is that 25 or 30% is considered reasonable, why shouldn't there be a cap, and why shouldn't there be an accommodation?
Let's take a phone call. Ben in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call. So for the last few years, I've been trying to aggregate data from different, mostly city agencies, so Department of Buildings, Department of Housing, and Preservation and Development. And what's interesting is that you can look at the Department of Buildings job applications, which the landlords have to apply for before they can do renovations, and you can compare that to their tax bills, and all of that is public. And what you find is that there have been many buildings where there's a huge drop in the number of rent-stabilized units and no corresponding permits to justify those increases. So, for example, a landlord can, if the apartment gets vacant, they don't bother to get a permit. They just offer a market rate lease, and the new tenant doesn't know that the apartment should be rent-stabilized, and they just get away with it. It happens in huge numbers of buildings all the time.
Are you familiar with this issue, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're pointing to, which is exactly right, is that most of the enforcement of the regulations that do still exist is reactive rather than proactive. And so that leaves a really huge loophole you can drive a truck through, sort of, where particularly between tenants, when a new tenant coming in doesn't necessarily know the history of the building or the history of the apartment they're moving into, will often not know that their rights may be getting violated and that the apartment has been illegally deregulated.
Where did the rent control and rent stabilization laws come from in the first place? And what was the difference between the two? Because they are different, rent control and rent stabilization.
They are different. So they originated actually after World War I, when there was a huge housing shortage in New York City. I don't know the exact date, but that was the time period we're talking about. There was an enormous housing shortage. It was a crisis in the city, and so rent control was put in place as a way to help alleviate that and to sort of help address what I suppose was the rampant speculation of its own time that tenants were facing, given the sort of unequal power dynamic of the market at the time.
And am I right that those laws were temporary and then they were brought back in a different way after World War II and the massive housing shortage at that time?
That's right, yeah.
So why don't we have the same system in effect today? I mean, at its peak, I think 2 million people in the city lived in rent-stabilized apartments. New construction of more than, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 6 units or more, mm-hmm. were largely covered. And that system ended, at least in terms of new construction, though there are still 1 million New Yorkers in rent-stabilized apartments today.
Yeah, so what happened was, I think the real estate industry and the landlord lobby sort of gaining power in the 60s and into the 70s, and that sort of happening as well at a time when New York City's housing market was declining in certain ways, and there was sort of crisis going on here and elsewhere in other cities around the country, contributing to sort of a shift in the politics.
I want to get to the economic argument against massive rent stabilization, and we have a caller who wants to make that argument, so I'm going to let him pose this. Ian in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Ian, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I believe that rent control and stabilization policies actually harm the very people they aim to help, because they create disincentives for landlords and developers to create new or renovate existing properties, and that puts a cap, on the charges for rent are actually a cap on availability. And so when you create scarcity of housing, you're going to automatically increase the value of the remaining housing, and that makes it more expensive for other people, regardless of their ability to pay. And if you had fewer restrictions, you would create more housing and hence more availability. And I think there have been comparative studies. I apologize, I don't have them at my fingertips, but I think there have been comparative studies between rent control areas versus similar demographic and areas in terms of availability, and the housing is more available and hence cheaper. And so that's why I think these policies are ultimately harmful to the very people that they aim to help.
Ian, thank you very much. And we'll do a separate segment later in the series specifically on this, looking at some other cities like Houston, for example, which is considered the un-New York in terms of having very loose zoning laws and rent control laws. And there's a lot of affordable housing in the Houston area, so I am told. They may have developed in a way that's very prone to flooding, which we saw recently, but it's easier to get affordable housing. So have you considered this argument? Sometimes landlords make it for their own purposes. They just want to be able to raise the rent. But some economists back them up with the exact language that
a caller was just using, some don't, that mass rent stabilization like we have and have had has contributed to housing shortages and therefore to crazy market rate rents because developers don't want to build with stabilized limits, not enough profit.
I have heard that argument before. It's been made in various ways at various times. And I have a couple of different things to say in response. One, and I don't know all the comparative studies or which one the caller is referring to, but in at least one other location that used to have a similar form of rent control and got rid of it, which was Massachusetts, what they've found is actually a decrease in affordability and no indication that that actually helped to tamp down the market or make more housing available. So that is at least one sort of counterexample that we can look to. I think the broader issue is if you think about New York City, it's a geographically small location that's enormously popular with a huge population. We can't sprawl like Houston does. We can't spread in the ways that at least some other places have. And so I think the idea that the market on its own is going to serve the need of the population here is not the case and hasn't been shown to be the case over the past decades, two decades, I guess now, since the clips you talked about in 1997 and the further sort of weakening of the rent laws, we've lost a lot of the regulated housing stock. And what we've seen is not that that has helped to loosen the market or make more affordable housing available, but actually that overall speculation has increased, prices have skyrocketed, and what's built at market rates, which there's no shortage of market rate housing being built, isn't going to accommodate the same population that currently is living in or needs the more affordable housing.
Sue in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sue.
Hello, thank you so much for taking my call. And I've listened to your show religiously, so thank you.
Thank you.
I want to address a program in rent stabilization, or a loophole in rent stabilization, that there's three ways you can be evicted in rent stabilized units. One is non-payment of rent, one is owner wants to live in your building, and the other is demolition. And I lived in a rent-stabilized apartment for 25 years in the West Village, and it was sold to the son of a billionaire who bought it for $3 million because it was eight units filled with rent-stabilized tenants. And then he filed eviction notices because he wanted to demolish the building from the inside and make it into a single family home and make millions of dollars. The going rate on my block for single family homes was $15 million, $18 million. So that's going on. And I think that it's something that I know Deborah Glick has been trying to address in the assembly and with not much success. And I think that's causing an erosion in a lot of rent-stabilized buildings.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're unfortunately not alone in that experience. One thing that hopefully will help to address some of those particular problems is a recently passed package of legislation at City Council that was grouped together as the Stand for Tenant Safety set of bills, 12 pieces of legislation specifically targeted at a variety of reforms about how the Department of Buildings does business, construction as harassment, and some of the issues that you're pointing out around landlords' use of demolition and other forms of construction to get rent-stabilized tenants out.
Well, I think what has been going on in our case is that basically he has the right to do this. And so we were facing either a long, long court battle or a settlement. And even with a buyout, it would be hard to translate that money into anything similar to what I was living in. And I'm a dancer and choreographer, so, I have limited means. I was extremely fortunate to end up in an affordable housing unit through NYC Connect. So I'm kind of have a foot in two different kind of situations.
It's a horror story when you're living someplace, and in your case, 25 years, and then the landlord decides they just want to knock it down and rebuild in their new image, and they can just kick you out. But thank you for illuminating.
I was there for 25 years, but I have older neighbors who were there for 40, 35, 30 years. I was there the least amount of time.
Thank you for your call.
Sure, thank you.
Before you go, Emily Goldstein, some of our upcoming segments in this series will look at ways to replace the rent stabilization system, since that's gradually dying on the vine, with other means of controlling rents, like Mayor de Blasio's zoning system, where they'll give developers the right to build higher than is currently allowed in a lot of neighborhoods, as long as 25 or 30 or some meaningful percentage of the apartments are considered affordable for certain income levels. How satisfactory is that, in your opinion, and what do you want to see at ANHD?
There's no way that makes up for the housing that's being lost. Something that's unique about rent stabilization, that's different from the way all other affordable housing programs basically work, is that it doesn't function on giving something to the landlords. And I know they don't like that, and I know that that's part of why it comes up against so much opposition. But it basically sets up a premise that limits the expectation of profits, and instead of pouring public money into an out-of-control market, sets limits on that market that have a ripple effect sort of more broadly in the city. And that's a lot of what's been eroding and fueling speculation. We're all for more affordable housing getting created, but creating it as a small percentage of what's actually much more market rate housing that then tends to fuel additional gentrification and displacement isn't going to address the real affordability crisis.
But then how do you see getting enough money into the system without all that private money being incentivized to develop the vast numbers of affordable units that the city needs?
It's tough. I think one thing is to strengthen rent regulation. It's true that it's been weakened and that it's been diminished, but I don't think we're ever going to be able to fully make up through it through pouring in public money. I think the other thing is to make sure that what public money we are putting in is going to the people who need it most. And part of what's been troubling is a focus on numbers of units rather than whether those units created are serving the people who are most rent burdened, who are most in need, and who are least able to find housing on the market.
Emily Goldstein, senior campaign organizer for the housing advocacy group ANHD. That's the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.